My name is Mildred, and I am an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. What do you say on the morning of the birthday of Alcoholics Anonymous, standing in the town where this birth became real? I'm quite overwhelmed by that fact. And as I woke up this morning, it just struck me. This is the birthday of AA, and you get to share your experience, strength, and hope. So I want to thank you for the gift that you have given me in inviting me here, for all the kindness that has been extended to me. I want to thank you, Audrey, personally, for your communication over the past months and for your kind words. I want to thank the other speakers for the messages they have delivered. You know, being left to Sunday morning is a two-edged sword. Part of it, everybody else has done the work for you. If I were to stand up here on my head and say nothing, you still would have had a good weekend, right? And for me, to be left to the end is like being the last person out of the chute. There's a group that has not been thanked, and I want to thank the bikers. What a beautiful tradition that is. I was sitting on my bed doing some spiritual reading, and I heard this sound. And I thought, I wonder if I can see them. And I opened the window. And I have to tell you, gentlemen and women who were biking, I prayed for every one of you. And I cried as I saw you go on your way to the cemetery. I felt watching that kind of like I feel when I stand before the ocean. It's too big. It's too meaningful. Words just don't do it. So I just sat there and was grateful that you were going on the way. And someday when I come back here and I don't have to speak, I hope one of you gentlemen will invite me. You notice I said, gentlemen, you got it. It was one of the highlights of the weekend to experience that. You just kept coming and coming and coming. There were hundreds of you. My mother had an opinion about bikers. I don't share it. I want to say, too, that I know thanks have been offered to the committee and to Audrey and to the volunteers. There's another person, I don't know if his name has been mentioned, and that is Don, who has done so much to keep the house of Dr. Bob and his family there for us to go and visit. If you've sat in that room, you know, in Dr. Bob's bedroom, or if you've sat at that kitchen table, you know how important an experience that can be. And then the people of Akron, you know, we just in Toronto had the international. We do it once and it's finished. You people do it every year. God bless you for the effort. God. Well, I'm here to, as Jack said last night, share what I was like, what happened to me, and what I'm like now. I was in the airport, as I frequently am, and some weeks ago, and I saw something that reminded me of me. It was a little boy with his daddy, and his daddy and he were having some little difficulty because Papa was trying to direct his attention to what Papa wanted him to see. It was obviously an airplane on the tarmac, And this little boy was maybe 2.5, 3, and he was interested on the fly in front of him. He wanted to look at the fly, and Papa kept saying, "No, over there, over there." And I thought, I think that's the story of my life, because what I'm going to talk about is the journey of my soul. I am an alcoholic, and that is the brokenness that God has used to get my attention. And I think my whole life, God has been saying, "Mildred, it's over there. Look over there." And I want to look at the fly on the windowsill. I really have nothing important to say to you except that, which some of all the speakers say in a different way. You know, in my life, if I tell you the truth, I'm smart, I'm competent, but I have lost a lot of things in life. Not because I don't know how to do stuff, and not because I can't learn how to do stuff, but I believe today that what has always gotten in my way is problems in my relationship with my God. And if I have problems in that relationship, I have problems with myself. And you can bet your bottom dollar that when I have problems with myself, I've got big stuff going on with you. And when I've got big stuff going on with you, the promotions go to somebody else, the loving goes to somebody else, the praise goes to somebody else, and I'm left saying, "What's wrong with me?" And I think it answers it on page 164, where it says, "See to it that your relationship with God is right, and great things will come to pass." See, that's where my problems were. And that means, of course, it's not the church's understanding of God. It's not your understanding of God. It has to be my experience. And I never understood that either. So let me tell you that I came charging into Alcoholics Anonymous in 1966. And I was excited. I was on fire. I'm at the place now. Well, let me tell you why I was so excited. I left home in 1950. Some of you weren't even a squint in your papa's eye. I left home in 1950, and when I left, my father said to me, he said, "Please make sure you say goodbye to your brother. You probably will not see him alive again." And 2 years later, he called me, and he was crying, and he said, "Mildred, a miracle has happened." He said, "Your brother who was dying is now alive. He's going to live. He doesn't drink anymore and he works. Good sign with my dad." He said, "Some man who used to drink too much alcohol came to our house and talked to your brother, and your brother stopped drinking. And he said, now he's been transformed." My father wasn't given to words like that. He said, "My brother was transformed, and by golly, I wanted to be transformed." And my father went on to say, "This new thing has come to the prairies." Remember, this is 1952. He said, "They call it Alcoholics Anonymous." He said, "I don't know what it is, but," he said, "I'll tell you this, it's good." My dad lived another 13 years, and he never could mention Alcoholics Anonymous, but he wept, and he wept with amazement at the miracle, and he wept with what had happened. He never saw me sober, but I'm sure wherever he is, he knows that the miracle has taken place with his youngest child, too. So, my brother was transformed. I want to be transformed. I'm in big trouble. Who am I at this point? 1966, 41 years ago. This is who I am. I've been locked up in mental institutions, psych wards, and insane asylums 32 times. You think that's funny? You're sick. I've been diagnosed with every mental illness in the book. I have had 38 electroshock treatments. That should give you a permanent shuffle, I can tell you. They used to put me in the cold water baths. They used to tie me to the bed, and it wasn't for fun and frolic. You think that's funny? That just adds to my opinion of your sickness. I had spent 15 years as a Roman Catholic sister in a convent, and none of that could fix me. So that's who I was. That's what I brought into Alcoholics Anonymous. And did I want AA? Of course I wanted AA. Then why am I not sober 41 years? Because I wanted AA on my terms. And you know, last night we saw all these wonderful newcomers. God bless you. Stay here. Let us help you. And if you think that when I talk about God and what has happened in my life through that relationship, and you think I am full of CRAP, I understand that. I thought that too when I came in. I didn't need God. I needed a man. I needed sex. I needed a house. I needed money. I needed a job. I needed to have some power in my life. Not G-O-D. I knew that didn't work. I'd been in a convent 15 years, for heaven's sake. So I needed Alcoholics Anonymous to work for me. I thought that I could park my hiney on those chairs, and thank you, Jack, for mentioning this. Don't drink and go to meetings is a good way to die, because I didn't drink. I went to meetings, and if you ask Cease Corrigal and you ask the crowd from Prince Albert, they can tell you that. I went to meetings, but I was doing AA my way, and I can tell you, I drank again. And when I finished up, I was on a park bench. I don't look like a woman who lives on a park bench, but I know all the ins and outs of living on a park bench, and I know how to live on Skid Row because I lived there for a year. The miracle of this program is, you know, when you see a wreck, and the bigger the wreck, and then you see that somehow or other it got straightened around, you know that somebody, something has been doing something in there. I don't live on a park bench today. I don't live on Skid Row today. And I do not have a Skid Row mentality, and I don't have a victim mentality. And that's not because I'm great and wonderful, but because I think God is great and wonderful, and God comes riding into our lives through this wonderful organization called Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, sometimes I'm grateful to AA, but I'm telling you, you are not keeping me sober. You are the vehicle through which grace has come to me. See, what was it that happened between Bob and Bill? Did they keep each other sober? I don't think so. Because if that were the truth, then we don't need the spiritual program. We don't need spiritual awakening. If I can keep you sober and association with you can keep me sober, I don't need to do this program. Then all I have to do is make sure I'm with a bunch of nice people. And we'll just be nice to each other and it'll all be over. It did not happen to me that way. I did not start to get well until I could get right with a power greater than myself. And you know, it's so beautiful. You know, you don't have to believe like I do. your experience. I can't tell you what I believe, but I know what I experience. See, anyway, I'm ahead of myself. How did I get to be such a mess? You know, the book says some of us had to be badly mangled. That's me. The book says we are in a state of pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. That's me. Thank you back there. You too. The book says life, alcohol beat us into a state of reasonableness. So, how did that all happen? Well, I started out life crying. You know, I know we've all been influenced by childhood. We've all been adversely affected. Look what Bill says in step 8 of the 12 and 12. He had that experience too. I was adversely affected by the fact that I had a retarded sister, and I was 3 and a half, she was 16, and she used to crawl into bed with me. And those were the days. And I bet they're thinking, how many years ago would that be? Honeys, I'm 74. Stop adding. They didn't know what to do with somebody like that. They kept her in grade 3 till she was 16. The kids in the neighborhood made fun of her. Her name was Dorothy. They called her Dumb Dora, and they made fun of her. We all need comfort. She came to me. I'm 3 and a half. And if you had taken a 2x4 and smashed me across the back, it wouldn't have hurt me as much as that did. And it became my mission to help her, to stop her crying. And what happened? Nothing. See, in those days, we didn't have Dr. Phil and Oprah and God knows who. People didn't talk about this private stuff. My family never once that I remember talked about this. And I'm lying at night crying, trying to make her feel better. And I'm trying to get the family to do, you know, and don't get me wrong. My family loved her dearly and took care of her. It just wasn't what I wanted. See, at 3 and a half, I didn't understand that everybody has a spiritual journey and all that stuff. I was just angry. I was angry and shut out my family. I came to believe I'm nothing, I'm not important, nobody cares about me. If they did, they'd fix that. See, that's all perception, and that all had to be healed. And Dora was my teacher, and I think I was her teacher too, because we both came to some kind of peace. Anyway, not at that time. Now, there was another player in that scene, and that was God. We were Roman Catholic. We went to church. I never heard that God was punishing. I heard God was love. Hey, this is good. God's going to fix this. Yeah? And then I heard that God is all the power. Well, for sure this is going to happen. And so I took my little 5-year-old body to my knees and said, God, here's the problem, here's the solution, get on it. You're laughing. I'm sure that's the echo of God's laughing when I told him what to do. See, Dora was my heartbreak. Dora also became the source of my healing. And I believe that. So often I think the thing that breaks us is also the place at which we get our healing. And so the interesting thing was, I didn't turn against God. I just considered God like a useless twit. Like, what good is it to have a God if he doesn't do what you tell him to do? It never occurred to me that maybe the shoe should be on the other foot. So at 5, I picked up a drink. Now, I'm an alcoholic from the word go. I'm a freeze-dried alcoholic waiting to be touched by the alcohol, and I'm off and running. The world changed. You know, you might as well have, like, it was like a new pair of glasses. I was just like my drunken brother. When he was sober, he had nothing to say. He was scared. He was withdrawn. He didn't know how to cope with life. And when he was drunk, he danced on the tabletop. And I was exactly the same. I love being drunk. I love drinking. I loved stealing the stuff. I loved whatever I had to do. You know, I drank for 35 years, and I'm not going to go into all that except to tell you that I drank whatever I could. If I couldn't get booze in the convent, I drank vanilla. Belched a lot, I can tell you. Smelt like a bakery most of the time. If I couldn't get vanilla, I could always find an excuse to buy perfume. Chanel No. 5 was my personal favorite, and I'll tell you, you smell very good from that, too. I had an enormous capacity, and, you know, I did what all the rest of you, if you're alcoholic like me, you spiral down. You start getting relief, you get release, you become dependent on it, and then you're addicted, and then the alcohol calls the shots. What was going on in my life? At 18, I decided to go to a convent. Not smart if you're an alcoholic. I was drunk the night I entered. I could hardly walk. I was so drunk. Honest to God, they took me anyway. Some of the other nuns, they used to talk about the night I came in. And, you know, they thought they were going to fix me. The interesting thing is that in 15 years, nobody ever challenged my drinking. It's amazing to me what you get away with when you work and are competent. People just didn't smell me. And so after 15 years, Mother Superior called me and she said, Sister, are you happy? Well, of course I'm not happy. Who's happy? So we wrote to Rome and I got my dispensation. And I remember standing on the convent steps January the 10th, 1966. I had no idea. I was a well-educated young woman. I had studied theology. I had studied philosophy. I had studied psychology. I didn't know a thing about life. I stood on the convent steps and I thought, you know, you can take the black and white habit off me. You can change my name back to my secular name from Sister Eugenia. You can dispense me from the vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience, and I'm okay. I was not okay. And it was not long before I had to go down to the bars. I found the booze. I found the men. And in 10 months, oh, and I found the jails as well. You know, when you've been in a convent for 15 years and 3 weeks later you're sitting in jail, there is something massively wrong with that picture. You know, I think of those 10 months as an absolute moral landslide. And I did not identify that I was an alcoholic. I didn't know that. I thought I was bad. I thought I was evil. And so at the end of that time, I had signed myself into what was known as 999 Queen Street, which was really the Ontario Insane Asylum. And somebody had said there was a doctor there, maybe could help me, and I went there. And my brother and sister found me there after 2 weeks, and I didn't want to leave. They took me to Saskatoon, which is how I got out there, and I met Dr. Hoffer. And after 6 weeks, Dr. Hoffer intervened. You knew, remember him, Tom? And he went to my doctor, and he said, this woman, she doesn't have all this psychiatric stuff. She's alcoholic. She should go to AA. And good Dr. McCarricker said, oh, he said, we couldn't let that happen. He said it would interfere with her treatment. Dr. Hoffer had enough clout that in a short time, Dr. McCarricker said, okay, you can go to AA. And I went to my first meeting in Prince Albert. And that's where I met a group of people. And I was so happy to be there. Cease Corbett became my first sponsor. And 3 weeks, I loved AA. I was right into it. I was right into parking my hiney on a chair is what I was into. And then after about 3 weeks, I realized something. Nothing had changed. You know, the big book says, doesn't it? Drinking alcohol is not the problem. It's the symptom of the problem. So you take the alcohol away from me, and if you think I'm nuts, When I'm drinking, you see me with untreated alcoholism, and then you really see trouble. I knew that there were things one could take called pills, and that's not the gist of my story, but I'll tell you, I sat in AA for 5.5 years stoned, and it just doesn't kind of work that way. It kind of clouds the way you do that fourth step. It kind of clouds who you think is the problem. You know, it shaves those amends into something, well, they should do it for me. And so for 5.5 years, I sat in AA. Now, the interesting thing was, Tom, maybe at that time you were already coming. I certainly remember Wesley Parrish used to come. Chuck Chamberlain used to come. Willard Pegg. And always, and Mac Cheater was still alive. And those of you that are older, you know these are some of the, I'm not going to call them giants. That's not what they were. They were strong members of Alcoholics Anonymous who believed in the principles of AA and who now, I realize, all had a strong God connection. And I understand now why I was attracted to them. They didn't try to give me what they couldn't give me. You can't give somebody a desire to stop drinking. But what they did was they talked to me and they tried to help me see that my way wasn't working. And of course, I denied. I'm sober. I haven't had a drink. And, you know, they always came. And I remember, you know, I remember those visits with them. And I remember some of the things they taught me. And after 5.5 years, you know, I couldn't stay. I'm a loser. I'm a loser big time. And so I walked out of AA thinking, I'm okay. I'm not going to drink. And within 2 days, I was drunk. I had jumped out of a two-story window. I had broken my feet. And I can go on and on to tell you that in the next year and a half, everything that the book says is going to happen. I had DTs. I had convulsions, and I could not stop. I was not in charge of that process. And I have to remember that because I can't keep myself sober today. The book says it. It says, I have lost the power of choice in drink. My job is to do the work so that God can keep me sober on a daily basis. And that's what I think is happening today. And I think if you're an alcoholic like I am, and you don't have a compulsion to drink today, God is touching you just as God is touching me. My husband was an alcoholic too. I married a psychiatrist. There's a very good move, isn't there, Bobby? Love coming into this area. Love seeing you, Betty and Bobby. And I couldn't stop. We lost everything because he began to drink too, and probably he was as sick as I was. I should never have had a second date with him. As a matter of fact, I should never have had a first date with him. They used to say of us, their neuroses are complementary. The rocks in his head fit the holes in hers. You know, let me say quickly, he was not my problem. I'd like to tell you he was my problem. He was an alcoholic who happened to be a psychiatrist. And he was a good psychiatrist. But as a person, he was like me, couldn't pull it off. And we drank, and we lost everything. And the last April and May, he was someplace else. We had lost the cars, the money, the da-da-da-da-da. I was living on a park bench, and I woke up on the morning of May the afternoon of May the 18th, in a psych ward, surprise, surprise. And there were two men sitting at the foot of my bed, and they really were there. One was a private detective who'd been hired by my family to find me, and one was a psychiatrist. And for 2 days, I couldn't move. And Sunday morning, I got up. The nurse took me to the washroom, and I saw myself. This eye was sticking out. It was swollen, purple. And I had kind of a half moon of purple across my face. I'll never forget it. My teeth were knocked out. My hair was straggly, and I weighed all of 85 pounds. And I remember screaming, and I said to the nurse, "I've become a woman of the streets, haven't I?" And she said, "Yes, you have. What are you going to do about it?" She took me to breakfast because I still couldn't walk very well. And after breakfast, she took me back to my room. And I sat there saying, "What am I going to do about this?" And I looked at my options. I had no money. I had no self-confidence. I was out of everybody. People had said, "Stay away from us. You come near us, we'll call the police." Family said, "You can come home, but you can't drink." Unacceptable. I couldn't have taken the job. I was broken, totally broken, and I was completely out of ideas. I didn't have one idea, except I thought, is this how I end? I'm going to become a prostitute on the street, selling my poor body, what's left of it, for a drink. And I said, "Nope, that's it. I'm out of here." And I made up my mind I was going to take my life. And I called the nurse, and I said, I'm leaving. I didn't tell her, because this wasn't one of those little cries for help. I had a plan. I knew how I was going to do it. And in half an hour, I was going to be gone. And she brought my clothes. She went to get my clothes, and something happened. In that room, I had a spiritual experience. In a heartbeat, the compulsion to drink was lifted. I didn't pray. I didn't ask. And this is something that tells me God reads our hearts. God knows what's going on in these spirits of ours. The compulsion to drink was lifted. It was as if a giant hand reached into me. And the compulsion and the obsession was gone. And I remember standing there thinking, I don't have to drink anymore. And then the second thought came to me. I don't know how to live. I'd been sober many times. I could always get sober. I could never pull off staying sober. Because it was always the world that intruded on me. It was the people. It was how I felt. It was the situations and the relationships and all that stuff. And I said, "Whoever, whatever you are, you'll have to send me somebody. And if you do, I will obey." I remember saying that, and there was a rap on the door. I swear to you that happened. And a man stood at that door. And he said, "I saw you at breakfast." He said, "I think you're in trouble, aren't you? Are you alcoholic?" And I gave a lovely answer. I said, "Yes, I am. Do you want to make something of it?" At which point, he would have been justified in hitting me. He said, "No." He said, "I came to see if I could offer you some help." He was the angel that God had sent. You know, if I can tell you nothing else, I can tell you this. I don't always see it at the time it's happening. But I have never, ever, in sobriety, needed something that it has not been brought to me. He talked to me about a place called Dawnwood, and he said, "I'll take you there." I didn't know what Dawnwood was. So 2 days later, he came, and he took me to what was then, we had no treatment centers, Dawnwood was a hospital run by Dr. Bell, who realized that addicted people needed good medical care. And I had my interview, and the nurse said, you need help, but she said, you have no money, so I can't keep you. And as I was leaving, one of those God shots, Dr. Bell shouting down the corridor, I can still hear his voice, keep that woman here and give her a bed. I got a bed, and I stayed there for a month. And it was the perfect place. You have to understand, at this point, despite being broken, I hated God. Do not mention G-O-D to me. And do not mention that ridiculous organization called Alcoholics Anonymous. Losers all. And, you know, Dawnwood, at that time, the way they were operating, they didn't make you go to AA. They gave you a little therapy. They gave you a little group therapy. And you had some good food. And some nurse did a little meditation with you. I could handle all that. And at the end, they gave me a little money because I had not 5 cents to my name. My clothes were in a little paper bag and a little suitcase. And they gave me enough money. I went down to Skid Row and got a room. And I remember, I come from a very respectable family, a family whose middle name might as well be Integrity. They don't live like that. I had never seen a room like this, and I opened the door and went, and I lived there for a year, and it was a blessed year. My psychiatrist said to me, get a job. And I got a job. I don't know if he thought I was going to go get a teaching job. He said, get a job. I knew what I couldn't do. I got a job sweeping a floor. And I swept a floor. And I was glad to sweep the floor. And then I got a job answering one telephone. And I was challenged with that. I was broken. And I know I was broken, and they knew I was broken. I said to Romana the other day, you know, I lived very small that first year. I didn't take up much space on the planet. I put one foot ahead of the other. I didn't go to AA. I just got up, did my thing, went to my job. And I'm grateful we had no money because it forced me to get out of myself. It forced me to get out of bed and do something. It wasn't much, but you know, once in a while, we had a meal. My husband kind of showed up. He couldn't always get past the fact that he used to run treatment centers and stuff. That's his story, however. And I was sober 6 months like this. No compulsion to drink. And one day I'm in the institution and a man says to me, would you like to come to a meeting? Well, I like being invited by men. And he says, would I like to come to a meeting? Yes, I would. I went with him. I didn't know where we were going. And I walked into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. If he'd have said, would you like to come to AA, I probably would have given him a sharp, smart answer. He said, so we went. It's my belief that we are the channels for grace. That group was, those people were a channel for God's grace to me. Because bitter as I was and messed up as I was, I kept coming back. I saw people who had more going for them than I did, and I grew to like you. And you welcomed me, and you said to me, keep coming back. I had nothing to give. You said, keep coming back, and I did. And I grew to love you, and it took about 3 months, and I ventured to get a sponsor. Brilliant qualifications. She had a white suit, gold earrings, and blonde hair. She was perfect. She taught me one thing before she got drunk. And that was, I used to complain about my husband, and she used to say, Mildred, He is not your problem. You can get sober and stay sober and get well despite what anybody else does. This is between you and your God. I had never been violent, and yet on January 1, I was ironing a shirt. And that morning, I decided, as I was there, the anger overwhelmed me that he wasn't working. And I thought, I'm going to take this iron and just go bang on his face. And I heard her voice. I didn't do that. And then I prayed, and that was the day things started to change. About a week later, she went out and got drunk. I don't know where she is. And there were two men in the group who knew that I was in trouble and that I had to do the steps. And those two men said to me, if you will come early, we'll read the book to you and we'll tell you what to do. Which I still think is what a good sponsor does. And they sat with me and they showed me what to do. They took me through the steps. We got to step one. Are you powerless? Yeah, I'm powerless. Is your life a mess? Yes, I can buy that. Step two. Do you believe that there's a power greater than you? Not really. Useless. They said, what do you think happened that morning of May the 20th? I couldn't put that together. See, I had no experience of God. I had no experience because I was so hard inside and my head was so full of intellectual stuff. And they said, well, do you believe that we're sober? Yes. Do you believe when we tell you we were a mess and some power? Yes, I can. They said, okay. So then we got to step three, and they talked to me about surrendering, giving up my old ideas. I said, it's never worked before. You guys forget. I spent 15 years in a convent listening to all this stuff. Well, they kept trying to show me that I was to make a decision that I would change the way I was, that I would do things different and think different. And the day came when they said to me, are you willing to kneel down with us and say the third step prayer? And I said, no. I'm not giving God that kind of power. Stupid. And they said, well, you know, Mildred, we've been patient. But they said, beyond this, we can't go. If you're unwilling to do this, regardless of how you feel right now, how you believe, you know, we have nothing else to offer you. And I said, okay, I'll kneel down. See, I don't think bunny points are given for intellectual stuff and understanding a whole lot. At this kind of time, you take the actions. And that's what opens the door to God. And that's exactly what happened. I knelt down with those men and I said that third step prayer. And you know, that's what enabled me to get out the pencil and paper, and they showed me how to do the fourth step. And the night before I did the fifth step, they told me to read my fourth step to God and to myself. And while I was doing that, the light bulb went on. All of a sudden I saw it. The world is not my problem. I'm my problem. I'm the stubborn one who has kept on wanting things to be different and so on. And I was able to go do my fifth step, and I was able to do six and seven, and I made my list, and I started the process of paying back the money, and I was sober a year. And 2 days before my first year medallion, I heard the voice say, go look in the paper for a job. I'm a high school teacher. I'm a college teacher. I was thrown out of the last place I ever taught. I thought I'd never teach again. And the voice said, go and look. And I looked, and there were three jobs advertised. I didn't even look what they were at, what kind of jobs. It was just for teachers. I applied for one, and I went to the job interview the day after my one-year medallion, and within 3 hours, they phoned me and said, "We want you to come." It was a God deal. I went to that interview, and I was as put together as I am now. Broken, most, I was only sober a year. I was quite nuts. Anyway, what happened as a result, I got a teaching job. We get paid very well, and I was able to start paying back the money. And from year 2 to 7, I worked at being a good member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had a sponsor who got drunk. Those men helped me do the steps, and then I got another sponsor. And he had a very big foot, and he did not hesitate to apply it to my backside. You know, those men had shown me the spiritual principles, and now he was an expert at showing, he helped me learn how to live. I didn't know how to get along with people. I didn't know how to get along with myself. I didn't know how to get along in the world. And he showed me so many things. He didn't let me get away with a thing. He'd say, "Phone me at 5 to 10, or at 10 o'clock. He didn't mean 5 to or 5 after. I said to him after a while, "Why were you so strict with me?" He said, "Because if I gave you an inch, you'd have taken a mile." And I learned from him. I'm so grateful because he took me the next piece of the way. And then from 7 to 18, another God shot. I had no money. I'd paid off all my debts and my husband's debts, and we were separated, and then we got divorced and so on, and life started to change. And I was able to buy a house. You know, 3 weeks before, my sponsor's accountant said, "You don't have any money." He said, "How can you invest?" God took care of it, and within 10 days, I had my first house, and I was to buy many houses, and I made a lot of money. And I say that for a purpose, because somewhere lurking in me, I wanted to be a man. I thought if I was a man, I'd have money, and if I had money, I'd have power, and all would be well. None of this being a sissy woman to me. Well, you know what happened? I made a lot of money, and it gave me the power to go places, do things, buy stuff, but it did not give me the power to get control over my life and to get control over other people's lives so that if you treated me in a certain way, I'd be okay. You see, there was a process that I had to go through. You know, Jack's process, as he described it last night, is not mine. It's not Tom's. It's not Wallace's. It's not yours. God is standing at the window of life with each one of us, saying, "No, look over there. God knows what I have to do." And the process that I went through was perfect. At 18 years sober, I'm sitting there in my fine house, my red convertible on the driveway, on my fine furniture, and I'm crying. Nothing has changed. I don't feel okay inside. I'm a good member of AA. If you look at me on the outside, I am a good member of AA. And anybody with any brains would have told you that. I go to meetings. I'm active in my group. I sponsor people. I am sponsored. I talk to my sponsor. I do stuff, you know, I try to be useful in the community. I'm not lying, I'm not sleeping around, well, much, but anyway, just thought of that. And for 2 years, I kind of unraveled. And I talked to the older members a lot, and wasn't okay. At 20 years, I broke up a relationship. You know, I'd had this relationship for 15 years. How do you have a relationship when you're living behind walls? He lived behind his walls, I lived behind mine. And a friend of mine used to say, oh, you two are so good together. Once we had discussed the weather, we had nothing to say to each other. So at 20 years, that relationship ended. At 21, I finally resigned from my job, and I realized, I remember the day that door closed. It closed on my heart. I had not prepared for retirement, and I thought, you know, I had no idea how I was going to live without that job and how much of me had been invested in what I did for a living. And one day I said, I think I'm out of here. And I had another spiritual awakening, and I knew it was going to be all right. I didn't know how. And I hooked up with a friend, an old timer, and he took me through the steps again. And we did the steps at a depth that I was not capable of in the early days. You see, when I did the steps at 9 months sober, I had a certain understanding. I could let a certain level of truth in, but we got to the root of things. And when we got to step four, he took me to a place where he showed me that, yes, in column four, I had changed those old behaviors, but I hadn't changed my old thinking system. The old thinking system from childhood that said, nobody really cares about you. You're not really important. You're a girl. You never really amount to anything. And he said to me, you know, every time you allow those thoughts, you're being disloyal to God. Because, you know, the book says, deep within every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. The outside is just the dance you do. That's all. Inside, your essence is whole and complete and perfect. And he did a process with me, and I got better. I got better, and, you know, it's always been my experience that as I do some things to change, something always comes in. And the phone rang, and it was a Jesuit saying, I've heard about you, and I'd like you to come and give some retreats. Well, I can tell you, doing retreats was as far from my consciousness as flying to the moon. I said, Father, I've been excommunicated many times. He said, I don't care about that. He said, I didn't ask that. He said, I want you to give retreats. So that's how I started giving retreats. And the very first retreat I gave was a real God shot. It was to a group of 65 women. And the very last morning, a morning like this, I'm standing in front of them and I start to bawl. I'm not a crier, and I sure don't bawl, and I certainly don't cry in front of women. A strategic tear in front of men is good. Crying in front of women is not my thing, and I'm bawling. And I said, and the words came out of my mouth, I don't have a friend in the world. I know lots of people, but I'm not close to anybody. And the walls were taken down. And it was a God shot. I felt like a chicken with no feathers. And I have to tell you, that was the beginning of a whole set of rich, wonderful, powerful relationships. I still don't have a man in my life. I keep telling the guys I give the retreats to, I'm taking resumes, but I'm still alone. Anyway, I want to talk a little bit about Dora to finish this talk. You know, and what has happened from that is a whole lot of growth, a different kind of growth, a deepening of my relationship with God. I started to meditate morning and night. I started a real serious reading of spiritual works, studying the masters and what they thought about the spiritual life. Because That's what nourishes this. That's how I got started. I got started in my brokenness with alcoholism. And you see, I think in the book it says, see to it that your relationship with God is right. And like any relationship, I've got to spend time with you if we're going to develop a relationship. I have to listen to you, and you have to listen to me, and that's how we get to know one another. And that's really what's happened in the last 13 years, because I'm sober 34 years. I would venture to say this to anybody sitting here. You start a program of meditation, take it serious. I don't care where you're at in the spiritual life. And if you will also add some spiritual reading to that and trying to practice the presence of God, you won't know yourself in a year. Because if you put that kind of effort out, God is there. See, I can do service work, but if I'm running on empty, what message have I got to give you? Are we okay? Okay. What message? I find that it's really important for me, not just to be out there. I've got to nourish that fire within me. That's what makes it all worthwhile. That's what, and if I don't nourish that, it's like the musician who said, if I don't practice one day, I know it. If I don't practice 2 days, some people know it. And if I don't practice 3 days, the whole world knows it. And I'm pretty well the same. If I, you know, think I'm too busy, I don't need to do this stuff today, I'll do it later. The first day, I know it. And the second day, a lot of people know it. And the third day, the whole world knows it. Because that, you know, I believe it's the fire within. Step 12 says, as the result of these steps, you're going to wake up spiritually. And I think that's a progressive situation. It's not that at 34 years, or 50 years, or 60 years, we're better off than the person who's 1 year sober. It's with every breath that God touches us. But it's a different perspective. You know, if I'm up here at 34 years, and I have the same perceptions that I had 1 year, you should run away. See? Now, I want to talk about a little bit about Dora. Because Dora has been my major teacher. I started out life thinking that I had to fix her. She started out life feeling sorry for herself. And so we moved along in this dance. I trying to take care of her, and we always had this special connection. My parents died in 1965 and 70, and you know, I realized how much they loved this child of theirs and how concerned they were that she be looked after. And one of my sisters took Dora. And my sister, who's very much in temperament like my mother, and my brother-in-law, they took her in. They had 5 little kids of their own, and she became one of their family. And, you know, I think there are angels, not just in AA. I often say that to my brother-in-law, and he says, oh, go on with you, go on with you. We just did what we should. They gave her a family, and she grew, and she changed. And one day I was out there, and I hugged her goodbye. And, you know, it was as if the life force in me just got sucked out into her. And I realized something. She'd had very little physical affection. She didn't have her own husband. She didn't have her own children. You know, some of my nieces and nephews used to say, don't let Auntie Dora rock us. And my sister said, I'd ask them, and they'd say, she holds us so tight. And I realized that day, she'd had very little physical affection. We weren't a hugging family. We're pretty stiff German stuff. And I said to, and I was on my way to the car, and she said, "Come here," after this. She said, "Do you still cry yourself to sleep at night?" And I said, "No." She said, "I don't either. I'm really happy." And when I went back to Toronto, I talked to my Jesuit spiritual director, and I was telling him this, and I said, "What does this mean?" He said, "You are really thick." He said, "She came with her journey. Obviously, God has brought her to surrender. He has brought her to a place where she accepts her life. You think you need to be smart for that to happen." He said, "You think you need to read books and you need to do all kinds of stuff." He said, "No, God has worked in her soul to bring her to peace." I was so glad we had that conversation. And then the day came when my brother-in-law called me and said, "Dora is dying." And I had just avoided that idea. He said, "If you want to see her, you have to come now." That very night, there were two of my sponsees in my house. They packed my suitcase. They got my ticket. They got everything ready. Poured me onto the airplane the next day. And I shook all the way to Saskatoon. I don't know how to do death. I've never been at a deathbed. Got off the plane, and I have to tell you, the coward in me was thinking, I hope that it's over when I get there. I have to admit that. And I would have missed the penultimate experience. My brother was there to get me, and he said, "Dora's waiting." He said, "She's in a coma, but she knows you're coming." He said, "She's waiting." And on the way to the hospital, I remembered something. And this is why I'm telling you this. This is the way this program works. 6 months before, I had gotten a call from a woman who said, "My mother just died, and I wanted to call you first, because," she said, "you helped me to be at my mother's deathbed." Well, I've never been at a deathbed. I never discussed it with anybody. She said, "You took me through the steps, and in the process, I changed." And she said, "While my mother was in a coma," she said, "I could pour love on her." She said, "I sang to her, and I stroked her." And she said, "She was in a coma, but I know that she knew I was there." And she said, "I was there to close her eyes." There was my answer. And I got to the hospital, and I got to the threshold of her room, and I'm telling you, all fear and all anxiety left me. And I stood like a little soldier at her deathbed. I was able to do that. I gathered the family round, and we sang songs that I hadn't sung in 50 years. And we prayed with her. And then they went off to have supper and sleep and so on, and I stayed. And I did a life review with her. She was in a coma, but I remembered what my friend had said. I'm sure my mother heard me, and I thought, "Dora, you hear me." And, you know, I tried to talk to her and say, "Let go if you have any anger left." And I talked to her about our experiences, she and I. And I sang to her. She loved the song, "You Are My Sunshine." And when I could get through it, I did. Then my brothers and sisters came back, and we pulled the life support, and Dora died. And just before Dora died, there's a sister-in-law I have I don't like. And she was at the deathbed, and Dora had her mouth open, and my sister-in-law said to her, Dora, you can shut your mouth. She said, it'll be easier to breathe, and Dora did. And I'm standing there at the deathbed watching this. About a year before, I'd been home, and one of my sisters was giving a dinner party. And I said to her, who did you invite? And she said, well, this one, that one, the other one. And she mentioned the sister-in-law. And I said, why do we have to have her? And my sister said, why don't you want her? And I said, because she's so pretentious. I said, she's always talking about how rich they are and how many important friends they have, etc., etc. And my sister, without missing a beat, said, she only acts that way when you're around. This was the sister-in-law standing at that deathbed. When I got back after a while, my spiritual director said, don't you understand? God was giving you a message that Dora had heard you. If she could respond 20 minutes before she died and 10 minutes before she died, God was saying to you, Mildred, Dora heard you and knew that you were there. And then Dora died. Now, I had had a thorny relationship with my mother. And just because my mother died and I did the work, there are some relationships take a lot of change and they take a lot of healing. And though I had done the forgiveness work, there was nothing to forgive. I just didn't like her. And that's another story. But that morning when I stood at Dora's deathbed and closed her eyes, I felt my dad and mom in the room. And I knew that any of the hardness that I had caused them, we were done. We were done. That I was totally and completely forgiven. And that's the way I think this program works. It's not about being good. It's not about being right. It's not about anything other than becoming totally dependent on our God and suiting up and showing up and doing what's in our path to do every day. And it's time now to stop. Hope I didn't make you uncomfortable with my weeping. I didn't set out to weep, but I guess you bikers made me emotional this morning. What can I say except may God's light be with each one of us, and may each one of us, as God says, hey, look over there. Let's look over there and see what it is that God wants to see. I love you from my heart. Bless you.